Welcome to Vase, a podcast about weird stuff. I'm Peter C. Hine, and I'm joined here, as always, by my colleague and good old friend, Stephen James Buckley.
Hello, everyone. So we're joined tonight by a guest, our second guest on Vase. He is a writer and journalist from magazines that you may have heard of, such as SFX, Total Film, and The Quietus. And his name is Will Salmon. Hello, Will.
Hey, fellas. How are you doing?
Yeah, it's good. It's good to have you on. So Will is someone that I know through initially through music, and then I think we bonded over liking some of the same television shows, particularly Lost, which I think was our in, wasn't it? Lost. And then a couple of years ago, Will recommended to me that I watch The Leftovers, which I did, and it became possibly my favourite TV show of all time. I'm, in fact, in the middle of a rewatch right now. So from then onwards, I just absolutely trusted Will on anything he recommended to me TV-wise, because he'd recommended me The Leftovers. So when he recommended to me a show called Hellier, I knew that it would be good. So I watched it. And if you've been listening to this podcast from the beginning, then you'll know that the rest is history as far as that goes, because that's what kind of brought us together and sort of what made us want to do this podcast. So Will is essentially kind of the reason why we're here, in a way.
So just 6 months ago, I was a relatively normal person living a relatively normal life.
Well,
probably three quarters of the way to being an atheist. And here I am today, a dirt-worshipping animist, a practitioner of magic. And indirectly, Will, this is your doing.
This is all my fault. Yeah, I'm so sorry.
You got to watch where you're flapping those beautiful butterfly wings. So
that's very kind of you.
So this show and indirectly you has been a massive influence on this podcast, as Buckley has said. But before we move on, should we talk a bit about who you are and what you do? So this gives some context to what we're going to talk about.
Sure. Yeah.
So, absolutely. You're as I understand it, through my research, through my sort of familiarity with your work, you're a journalist, writer, and you sort of write about pop culture with a skew towards science fiction and fantasy and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess so. I started out as a music journalist quite some time ago. I still do a little bit of that for websites like The Quietus and a few other outlets. But then probably in 2009, I started working for SFX magazine, which is it's a really long-running British science fiction magazine that started in 1995. I've been a reader since issue one, so that was kind of, you know, a huge delight getting involved with that, first as a freelancer, then on staff, and then back to freelance. And yeah, so I write about film. I tend to specialize in horror. I launched a horror movie magazine a few years back called Horrorville, which was, well, we lasted five issues because we cost too much, but it was pretty well liked at the time, even if it only lasted about a year. Continue to write about that genre and other stuff today. So yeah.
So how did you first come across Hellier then?
Do you know what? I was listening to, I think I heard the same episode of Euphemet that the Weird Studies guys did, because I listened to, in prep for this, I was listening to the Weird Studies episode that you guys mentioned, which is great. Yeah, it's a really good show. And like, that's a show that you turned me on to last time I saw you. You mentioned it. And so I've heard quite a few episodes of that now. And they mentioned that they heard about it through Euphemet, which is a podcast that I like. I find some more compelling than others, I will say.
Yeah, yeah. But
that one I found really, really intriguing. So I went and watched the first one. And yeah, it's a very divisive show, Hellier. And I think it's one of those ones that either gets under your skin straight away, or you'd just be like, what is this? You know?
Are you able to give us sort of a short summary for anyone who's listening? So people who are listening to this, we're assuming, have watched Hellier. So there's going to be spoilers ahead, and there's going to be probably discussions of parts of it without much context. But are you able to give sort of a quick sort of summary of what Hellier is, or what it's about?
Yeah, sure. So it's about, well, first of all, it's a true story. I say with heavy air quotes, it's a true documentary about a group of paranormal investigators who receive some mysterious emails that lead them down the first of a series of intriguing rabbit holes about supernatural phenomena in Somerset. That's the American Somerset, not the Somerset where I am currently sat in the UK.
I didn't realize you were in Somerset. That's just a whole new...
Yeah.
Wow. Of course you're in Somerset.
Yeah, where else?
But yeah, so they investigate this mysterious story about goblins who have been besieging this doctor in this remote town. And they go out to investigate it and then find that the doctor is either never existed, or he existed under a different name, or who knows what else, but he's not there, basically. And as they investigate this, they stumble down a series of increasingly strange pathways. Their lives take on a strange kind of series of coincidences and synchronicities that seem to indicate that they are on some kind of magical or occult path. And it's really fascinating, because I said earlier, like, true in air quotes. And I think the biggest question that I have over Hellier, and I don't know how you guys feel about it, is I have no idea how much of it is true, because certainly some of it is, but also it's a television program, or rather initially a YouTube series. You have to come at it with a certain degree of skepticism, because obviously some bits have been contrived, but it really blurs the boundaries in a way that I find absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I watched the first episode on your recommendation, because you'd not told me anything about it really, so I didn't know what to expect, and I wasn't sure if it was a real documentary or if it was a sort of mockumentary. And I think some of that was just because the production values are so good. I wasn't used to seeing documentaries all of the shots and the music and the lighting, everything is just like phenomenal compared with pretty much every other paranormal documentary that I've ever seen.
Yeah, it really does make it stand out, doesn't it? I mean, it's Carl Pfeiffer, who's actually one of the main investigators in the program, who does I think he does basically everything, doesn't he? He directs it, he films a lot of it, he edits a lot of it. It looks like, they must have done it on a small budget, but it looks, you could almost imagine seeing that on HBO or something, couldn't you? Yeah. I mean, it looks almost perfect.
Yeah, they've clearly put a lot of time and effort into making it look like a proper TV show, you know? It's within that kind of genre of true paranormal shows. But I think the thing for me that I find fascinating is almost all of those. I mean, I've never watched anything like Most Haunted, recently the Skinwalker Ranch show. And I've never watched any of those and come away from them believing them for a second.
No, I mean, Derek Okora, this is not... Like, yeah. I don't mean to speak ill of the dead, but like, I'm not a fan of Derek Okora's work.
No, I met him once.
Side note, God.
Yeah.
Before or after he died?
Before, but it was, he was very strange. He's telling me all about his spirit guide, which was, I think he said, like a little African boy from 2000 years ago or something. I was like, okay, cool.
It was actually... Because I'd heard about Hellier, I heard of it through Buckley months before I watched it, And it was the connection to that kind of basically trash TV that put me off watching it, really, because I thought, like, I don't have time in my life to watch one of those. And then the difference when I started watching it, because that first episode, possibly more than any of the others, is truly creepy.
Yeah.
When they're doing the reenactments of, and they do the read-throughs of the emails and so on. And it really does sort of still make, yeah, I rewatched it recently. It does make the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, all that first bit with Christy and the email and the photographs and everything. It's just very, very creepy. Really, really, I mean, you know, quite powerful television, really.
Yeah, absolutely. You're watching that, and, you know, obviously when you get into the series, you get into the rhythm of it, and you start to kind of go, like, the famous thing that people say about Hellier is, like, one star, no goblins.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a show that's initially about goblins, and spoilers, you don't ever see any goblins. But in that first episode, you're really kind of like, well, I might, you know?
Yeah.
I might
see something.
The other thing that makes it seem less real in a way is the absolute perfect, air quotes, casting of the show. You know, the characters that there are. You know, because you have the initial core team of Greg Newkirk and Dana Newkirk. They're professional paranormal investigators. They're married, obviously long-standing pre-existing relationship there, and they also both have experience on TV, so they are very, very camera ready. They're also like a completely adorable couple, and both together and individually very, very, very watchable. And then you have Carl and Connor, who are much more like you'd imagine paranormal researchers to be, you know, a bit more contemplative, you know, like slightly more geeky. And they're also like immensely likable characters. And then in the second series, you have the addition of Tyler Strand, who, again, you know, he's just like an incredibly likable person.
And he's like, I mean, we were discussing this just before, like, I think we'll maybe come back to it later, circle back to it, as they say. But I think that's actually quite an important thing, like the characters, so to speak, in it, in terms of how it's received. But I think, like, it's almost like the Ghostbusters or the Beatles. It's almost like it's been put together. You know how, like, a pop band might be put together by a committee or something, and it's like we need the one that's a bit naughty and kind of tough, and we need the one that's the really good looking one, and we need the one that's actually a good singer and stuff. You know, like the kind of boy bands and girl bands from like the '80s onwards, and it's like they've almost been chosen, isn't it? And you just think, like, okay, but these people haven't been put together by a committee or an outside group of people. They've just come together as, like, naturally, organically, as a group. And then you think, but maybe there's something in that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because they're fulfilling archetypes.
Yeah.
If you'd sat down to write a cast of characters for a paranormal show, you couldn't have done much better than those characters. You know, they are filling, I think, archetypes within it. I mean, I would say, like, watching this, you know, because it does, that's what makes it feel more like a television series. And I think that's why some people watch it and don't realize that it is actually a documentary and it's not a scripted TV show, because it goes back to, we were saying earlier, it reminds you of almost like the Goonies or something, you know,
yeah.
Or even further back to like Saturday morning cartoons. Because I'd say, like, that Greg is Fred, Dana is Daphne, Connor is Shaggy, Carl is Velma, and then Tyler is Scooby. You know, you've got like a really good, like, mystery machine full of really exciting, interesting characters with incredible dynamic and chemistry between them.
Yeah.
So you're saying that we're gonna find a goblin and pull the mask off, and it's Alan Greenfield?
Yeah. Maybe so. Who knows? You know, there could be multiple masks in there. You know, it would be like the front cover to the passport from to Magonia. You know, just mask after mask after mask coming off.
This is one of the things, isn't it? With and I don't know really anything about Greg and Dana personally, but their background is very much, they run a paranormal museum, right?
Yeah,
and there is a certain amount of showmanship there. And I don't say that in any way to slight them or to imply that they're making anything up, because I'm genuinely not saying that. But there's definitely an awareness of their image
and definitely
putting on a good show, you know?
They know what they're doing.
And that's what you need for something like this, though, because it's like a really well-produced but influential album. You know, it's like, you know, if you want to get someone into Nirvana, you don't play them Bleach, you play them Nevermind.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's it. I think that a lot of people are being eased into this world, which was previously mainly just for geeks and, you know, which is this idea of the ultra-terrestrial universe, the John Keel, Jacques Vallée. People are being eased into that by a really well-put-together show that's got a bit of polish to it with some fantastic, likeable characters. And as you say, they know how to play to the camera and interact to the camera. And I think that is part of, we could probably discuss this in more detail later, but that's part of the magic that's drawing people into this world and then setting them off onto new paths. So we've gone through the main characters there, and people obviously were presuming they've watched it. But the other character, again, we're using a lot of scare quotes here, but is the phenomena itself, which is present from the very beginning and casts a long shadow over the entire show. And the way that this begins at the very beginning of the very first episode is with a description of synchronicity. And that's really almost the theme of the whole show in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
I was just going to give a description of synchronicity. Again, I'm assuming that people who are listening and have watched Hellier will know what a synchronicity is. But basically, Carl Jung described that as an acausal connecting principle. So he said, synchronicity is the coming together of inner and outer events in a way that cannot be explained by cause and effect and that is meaningful to the observer. And a book that both me and Buckley have read recently is The Occult Experiments in the Home by Duncan Barford. And what he said is that synchronicity is the assumption of a non-causal force at work in the universe, so that events are connected not only through cause and effect, but also through their meaningful affinity with one another, which kind of takes it a step further from Jung, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically like a meaningful coincidence, isn't it? I realise my job on this show now is to be the Venkman of Vase, and I've got to explain things. I've got to explain things in a way that like the casual listener might understand. So yeah, it's like a coincidence, but the kind which has a lot of heavy meaning attached to it. So it's almost the opposite of a coincidence, because a coincidence by definition is meaningless, whereas synchronicity is the one where it's got some kind of meaning to your life.
But that's a good way to put it, because taking it down to that level of simplicity, which is much needed, is where they are at the beginning of series two, isn't it? Because I think that when a lot of people have watched this, they're saying, well, actually, these synchronicities are just meaningless coincidence.
Yeah.
And they begin season two by saying, we can't tell what's noise anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we can't tell what's just coincidence, we can't tell what's synchronicity, we can't tell what's meaningful, we can't tell what's not meaningful.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that for me is most interesting about Hellier is, and I you know, I'm interested in occultism and magic. I'm not particularly well versed in it, I'll hold my hands up there, but I think the thing that you kind of rapidly hit upon when you do start practicing stuff or have any kind of experience in that world is just how your life suddenly becomes a little bit weird in some often kind of mundane ways. So you do start to notice coincidences and synchronicities and just odd things happening that are generally often pretty low key. It's not like you're suddenly manifesting actual, you know, visions and things in the room, although I'm sure some people probably do, but it's just the odd little things that you notice. And what's interesting about Hellier is it lives in that world. It lives in that world of, they keep seeing balloons, and maybe that doesn't mean anything, maybe it does. And then by the end of the series, they have a meaning for it, you know, and that's kind of fascinating and interesting. Or they need to go somewhere really urgently, but they can't because a tree has come down and blocked the road. And what's on the end of that tree? Oh, a balloon, you know, and just weird little moments where it feels like you're getting a little glimpse into the workings of reality.
Yeah, somehow. I think that's exactly it. I mean, one way that you could look at it is it's almost like proof that the universe is a simulation. Like, I'm not sure that it is, but it's almost that same way of thinking, isn't it? It's almost as if there's a structure to it, or there's something behind the scenes which we're not in consensus reality isn't acknowledged. But Hellier sort of demonstrates, and other things similar to Hellier, you know, Mothman prophecies, for example, demonstrates that sort of that whole thing where it's almost like you start to see the strings. You start to see that what's behind, and it's sort of like you don't see where the strings go or who's pulling them, but you certainly see patterns that you wouldn't otherwise see. And that's, you say, that's where Hellier is. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And what Will was saying before as well, because it's what Greenfield keeps saying, which is follow the synchronicities. What you were saying, Will, was that when you start dabbling, you know, in magic or the occult, the first thing that you start to notice is these meaningful coincidences. And my personal take on that, having sort of within the last 6 months started a magical practice and so on, is that those are there low level all the time. And the first thing that you do through, you know, meditation and mindfulness, you know, which is the very first steps of magic, and you're recording your dreams and just taking note of the way that things interconnect, is to notice those, which is just like what Buckley was saying, you know, almost like the fibers that are the interstitial tissue in reality starts to become more apparent. You know, this is actually connected to that, and when that moves, this also moves. You know, that's how I see synchronicity. But then once you start to notice that and look into it, it looks back and starts to notice you as well. And I think that that is when things really start to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's the, it's again back to the Mothman prophecies. Like, it, things weren't that weird in Point Pleasant until Keel turned up. Like, they actually got a lot weirder once Keel turned up, as in the feedback idea of it, you know, once you start looking at it, especially someone like Keel starts looking at it, it starts to like amplify and increase.
Yeah, and I think this is a good time to mention Pennyroyal because of that exact principle. So one of our favourites, Dale Cooper from Twin Peaks, said, "When two separate events occur simultaneously pertaining to the same object of inquiry, we must always pay strict attention." And Pennyroyal is pretty much the shadow of Hellier, in a way. So for people who may have only seen Hellier and not listened to Pennyroyal, I think, did Will introduce you to Pennyroyal as well?
Of course he did,
Yeah. So I'll take on trying to describe Pennyroyal.
Because you're notoriously good at making things brief.
Succinct. Yeah. So Pennyroyal is a podcast, basically, which starts to look into the events in Kentucky. There's the Mammoth Cave system. There's the Pennyroyal Fault as well. Can you describe the Pennyroyal Fault, Buckley? Because I know you've got a better grasp on that than I have.
Well, the idea is that there's an area in Kentucky, Somerset, Kentucky, where there's a large area of quartz underneath the ground, and there's a whole system of caves, and it's supposedly causing a lot of weird shit to occur. And Pennyroyal is a podcast where there's a guy called Nathan Paul Isaac, who's a fantastic researcher, who starts out looking at some of these weird things that are happening in this area, just in terms of basically his area and the connection between place and things happening. And then it kind of, his research gets deeper and deeper, and he spreads out into the wider world, into kind of synchro mysticism and into like international conspiracies. But it's all still linking back to this one place where there's certain like geographical and magnetic anomalies in the ground. And it ends up being that this is linked to Hellier. It turns out that he's on Hellier. He actually shows up on one of the episodes, and then in season two of Pennyroyal, Greg then comes on to Pennyroyal. Yeah. No, that's
it turns out that they're basically researching the same thing almost, doesn't it?
Yeah,
very much. But the thing with Pennyroyal is obviously, so there's the fault, which is a magnetic anomaly which runs through the Pennyroyal Plateau, and there's also huge deposits of quartz, geodes in the in the ground there. And he has this theory that there's some sort of, piezomagnetic effect, that which basically amplifies this strange energy. But like Buckley was saying, it really goes deep down the rabbit hole. You know, they really follow the synchronicities, and it's very difficult to talk about it. You just have to listen to it, because to talk about it is actually just to recite everything that they're saying. But it goes, I mean, international conspiracy, it goes into occult Nazis, it goes deep into magic. It's absolutely intriguing. It's mind-boggling, and it is dense. It is really, yeah, really dense. It's got to be one of my favorite podcasts I've ever listened to, yeah, because it's so beautifully done, and all the researchers in that are just absolutely fantastic. That they make some connections there that are just really, really odd. You know, like, so much stuff converges back onto Pennyroyal and Somerset, Kentucky. They link it through to Crowley, Parsons, by way of, I mean, who else? There's the King Kill,
James Shelby Downard, and all that.
Harry Cruz.
The occult history of Route 66.
Absolutely mind-boggling. But you end up in the same place, which is that you're thinking, like, how much of this is meaningful? Because I would say that Pennyroyal turns up the noise a lot, you know, in that a lot of this is either supposition or just coincidence. I mean, you have to remember that Kentucky's massive compared to, like, England or something. I mean, Kentucky is a huge state as well. You know, there's a lot of space in there, you know, and the idea that they've managed to find, you know, significance in who owns a specific mine or what happened on as a specific roadway passed through the state or whatever, some of that could actually just be coincidence.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, in some ways it is, like you say, it's a hard show to talk about because you just kind of fall into the thing of repeating little interesting nuggets of history that they've dug up, but not all of them. I think he does reach sometimes, maybe a little bit, but then I don't know if that's a bad thing or not, because it all adds to this kind of just fascinating sort of strange occult history of the area, that is enchanting and, you know, certainly captivating to listen to. And maybe that's the most important thing, right? Whether, you know, whether there is any direct link between these things or not, maybe it's the fact that it makes you believe it for a while you're listening to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful to get immersed in. I found it incredibly immersive, and it's just something that you can get lost in. And I often find that with things that are, you know, that kind of have that boundary between fiction and non-fiction. It's sometimes, you know, like, I've often enjoyed, like, conspiracy theories, not the, like, dodgy racist ones that have come out in the past, like, 4 or 5 years, but, you know,
QAnon.
Yeah, like, your classic conspiracies, your JFK and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because it feels like you're reading a really immersive piece of fiction. And I feel like that with Pennyroyal. I feel like you say, some of it, I'm not sure how connected it is, but it doesn't matter, because what it did was create this wonderful feeling of, like, immersion in this world, and also encourages you at the end to go ahead and do that yourself and do something yourself. And that I found really, you know, spurring, kind of, you know, it makes you want to do stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah, Pennyroyal is like looking at someone's conspiracy corkboard, isn't it? With the bits of red string connecting things. And it just so happens that the person who's showing it to you has a lovely, lovely voice.
Oh, yeah. The thing which I think is the most interesting for me personally in Pennyroyal is the whole idea of the cybernetics and the feedback, and the idea that when you look at the phenomenon, it looks back at you, and then you create this feedback loop and things start to happen with increasing intensity. And I think that that's something which is obviously demonstrated by Hellier and other similar, like I say, like the John Keel thing as well. And I think that that's a really interesting point that really stuck with me.
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to what you were saying about being able to see it a bit like a simulation, doesn't it? Because Nathan Paul Isaac brings it back often to information.
Yeah.
second order cybernetics is what you're talking about. And I've got a quote by from him here, which is a fairly lengthy quote, but it really, really sums up Pennyroyal. He says that at the heart of what we call reality is information. And that information for our own safety is hidden from us in the same way that files are hidden on our computer that only an admin can access. If we could easily access the information, if someone without knowledge of how those files worked and what their function was in the system as a whole was able to alter or damage or delete them in the system would crash. In a consistently fractal way, the deeper layers of the system that we call reality are probably encrypted for our safety to avoid a cosmic system error. But magic and other esoteric practices and methodology, including cryptography and gematria, allow the practitioner to decide reality and gain access to these hidden admin files and features. And no doubt here we might also find the natural domain of what appears to us as the phenomena. And I think that that's his sort of idea, is that these synchronicities form some part of reality that we're not really supposed to be looking at.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating and unsettling idea, isn't it?
It's kind of inspiring as well, though. It kind of, because it has like a kind of crossover into like almost, you know, something more like the Matrix or something like that, you know. But then it's also got implications that lead more towards things like the ultra-terrestrial theory and things. It's like a, Pennyroyal's almost like a, not a universal theory, but it's something which kind of universally brings together a lot of different really fascinating things.
It's an incredible primer for high strangeness, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's also I would say, like, coming back to Hellier, it's almost like background research for Hellier. Almost, I feel like you could watch Hellier on its own and really enjoy it, but then what Pennyroyal does is almost give you like the context and the depth behind it. And that makes it a whole lot more enjoyable. Like what, listening to Pennyroyal afterwards or during or beforehand.
I think that if sort of Hellier kicks open the door to this sort of lodge of high strangeness, I think that when you walk in there, it's all been decorated already by Pennyroyal. So talking about this as like a primer, you know, Hellier and Pennyroyal as primers, you know, that can draw people into this stuff in quite a palatable way, you know, in quite a way that's easy to digest. What do you think, Will, is, given your line of work, the cultural significance of Hellier, or if there is one?
I mean, I think there's a few ways to look at that. I mean, I think on a very grounded level, it's just fascinating to see an independent project like that that is so far outside of any kind of mainstream. You know, you can watch it on telly now, you can it's on Prime, I think, you can buy Blu-rays now, but I believe it started as a YouTube show.
Yeah, it's certainly still where on YouTube.
Yeah, that's where I first saw it, yeah. So it's interesting just from that level, seeing something that is a very, very small scale project that is also incredibly niche. I mean, like, everyone loves spooky shit and everyone loves shows that explore this stuff, but the way they go about it is really, really obtuse, and that's why I like it, because it's kind of defiantly anti-mainstream in some ways, and yet it's obviously really struck a chord with people. And I think that's because there is, whether you believe in this stuff or not, they've somehow hit on some kind of kernel of truth. You know, it's not just us saying this. Like, if you listen to many people who are much more in this world than I am, they'll go, yeah, it's because it feels real. This is what it feels like when your life becomes a bit magical or a little bit strange. So I find that fascinating. I think it's interesting the way that it's so open-ended and vague, that it has a narrative arc of sorts. Also, not really. You know, it doesn't really have an ending as such. They just kind of, they get some interesting answers, maybe, to what's possibly going on, and then it just sort of stops for now. I don't know if they're going to make a season 3 or not, but I find that interesting as well, and again adds to its sense of truthfulness. It doesn't try to show too much, and I think it's interesting it's coming out at the same time as just a resurgence of interest in this sort of stuff. I mean, obviously we talked about Pennyroyal. There's a film coming out very soon called Something in the Dirt, which is which is very, very good, and is also exactly about this stuff. That's a film by Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, who did a film called The Endless. So I think you're a fan of Buckley, right?
Massive fan of The Endless and Resolution. They're incredible films.
Yeah. Well, you will definitely enjoy this when you see it then.
Yeah.
I won't get too deep into plot stuff, but it's fiction, obviously. It's set in LA. It's about two guys who move into an apartment complex, and they immediately discover actual verifiable evidence of the supernatural in their apartment. And what the form that takes is basically, I think it's like an ashtray or something, just starts floating. So they set out to document it, and they start researching it. But as they're documenting and researching it, their lives start to kind of unravel as coincidence and synchronicity pile up on top of each other, to the point where they're basically, they can't really go out the house without seeing something. They're like, oh God, how does this tie into such and such?
Yeah.
And it's absolutely about that chapel perilous state, if hopefully I'm using that term correctly.
Yeah.
That feeling when everything takes on that sort of illuminated significance.
Do you think that was directly influenced by Hellier?
No, and I know this because, so this is an example of manifestation at work, I think. So I saw this film at Fright Fest in London a couple of months back, which is a film festival. And so a friend of mine who writes for the Wire magazine was also there, and he tweeted about how much he liked the film. And I replied to him, I loved it so much. I absolutely need to meet the directors and ask them if it's if they've seen Hellier and things like that. Literally hit send on the tweet. 5 minutes later, they walk into the bar where I am, stand right next to me as I'm dancing to the Cheeky Girls. And like, a few drinks in, Dutch Courage and all that, I just pivot to them and go, so have you seen Hellier then? And I can't remember if it was Justin or Aaron said basically no, they hadn't. They're aware of it. I think one of them said they'd watched a few minutes of it, but not really persevered. But they did just give me this wonderful quote, which was like, I said, why do you think this is all happening at this time? Why is everyone into this stuff now? And I think it was Aaron Moorhead just said, I think we're at the beginning of a global awakening, man. I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah,
that is a really interesting story.
That is kind of ties into what we've been thinking Hellier is about. Really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's what Greg Newkirk said that he wanted Hellier to be about. He said, I was listening to a podcast just today, actually. It was Somewhere in the Skies, number 138. And in that, Greg said, I want it to re-enchant the world. I want people to look at the world differently. I want them to pay attention to the synchronicities in their lives and see what those synchronicities might mean to them.
That's literally what happened to us, isn't it? Like, Vase is like exactly what Greg wanted.
Yeah, exactly. That's on a small scale, but a large scale, that could be a global awakening. I mean, not necessarily from Hellier, because you've just said that those guys hadn't seen Hellier, but the fact that something is happening, and maybe Hellier is just a symptom.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, I'm not super well versed in all this stuff, but you see ties back to things like obviously Vallis, the Philip K. Dick book, and Robert Anton Wilson, who you turned me on to, Buckley, and all this kind of stuff. It's been there in the background for a long time. It just feels like for whatever reason, it's having a real moment. And I don't know why, but it's very, very interesting.
I think one of the things is like, when you look at something like Cosmic Trigger, which has quite a lot of similarities to Hellier, as often gets brought up in discussions about Hellier, I think that the thing with that makes Hellier almost a bit different is that it's very now. Like, Robert Anton Wilson didn't have the internet when all this stuff was happening to him. Philip K. Dick didn't have the internet, although he was probably dreaming of it. But like the fact that it's there, the fact that Hellier is kind of being broadcast on the internet. It's because it's beyond TV age. This isn't TV age. This is like internet age, yeah, sort of thing that's happening. And I think that makes it a bit different. I think that makes it kind of like almost more powerful, because if you think in terms of feedback loops, think how much stronger the feedback loop is when you've got thousands, tens of thousands of people all watching it and feeding back into it, as opposed to something like a book, which spreads a lot more slowly. I mean, I still think the comparisons to Cosmic Trigger are really valid, because I think Cosmic Trigger is probably the book that influenced most of the people that went on to do podcasts like ours. You know, like it's I think that was kind of almost the hellier of its time in a way. But I think Hellier will almost do it perhaps even more, you know, in a similar way, but actually more powerful, because the internet is designed for that kind of communication and that kind of networking and that kind of spread of ideas. And it's like a perfect growth medium for whatever it is that's growing and whatever it is that's growing it to happen.
Yeah, I think that's right. The way that I think about it with Pennyroyal and Hellier is almost like media as a virus. You know, these ideas are now actually getting into people's psyche, you know, so probably more than maybe any other television show, Hellier changes people who watches it. You know, if you watch Hellier and you're the right sort of person, it can have a dramatic effect on your mind and even your life, as we are almost living examples of, really. I heard someone describe it as the only TV show that when you watch it, it watches back. But that's not too far from the truth, you know. I think there is almost like there's some sort of awareness, if not in it as an egregore, you know, to use the sort of buzzword of the time connected to Hellier, but even if it's as some sort of network of influence running through the internet, as Buckley was saying, that there's something more to it than just a static work of art or whatever.
No, I definitely absolutely agree.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that, and not to drag us too off topic, but I think it's fascinating how you do have certain works of art that can do that. I mean, so for me, I don't know if you guys have read The Invisibles, the Grant Morrison comic.
I've started it. I'm not all the way through it.
Right. So that's, you know, that's an example of, that was written in the 90s, and that is an example of a comic that was specifically designed as an occult practice, right?
Hypersigil.
That's the word that Grant Morrison used with typical kind of showmanship again. that's so densely packed with esoteric ideas pulled from many, many places and many philosophies and ideas. And like reading that, I would have been, 15 when I read that for the first time. And then suddenly you get to, I think it's issue 11, and he's drawn a sigil in the back and he's like, hey, save our comic from being cancelled by wanking over this sigil. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I'm 16, but I'm not going to do that. Sorry, mate. But you know, those ideas have never left me, and that interest in occultism, I have to a degree, started there. So yeah, and then from The Invisibles, you then get something like The Matrix, which obviously is a hugely influential film, like a massive, massive moment when that comes out, and that is running with a lot of the ideas from The Invisibles. I mean, it's widely acknowledged that comic was an influence on the set. It was a big shock to Grant Morrison going to see that film and then kind of going, oh, they've made the film of my comic, just in a slightly different context. So I find it interesting how these ideas do become kind of like virus-like and, you know, pass from one media to another and just take root in your brain.
Yeah, and I think another TV show that's done that for me as well was True Detective, which again had that influence from The Invisibles. You know, there was some debate about whether some lines had been lifted directly from The Invisibles, I think, through the first season of True Detective.
What a fascinating show that is as well. I'm not going to lie, I did not stick with it. I gave up on season two, and I liked season three, but season one is just such a perfect example of weird fiction, isn't it? Just such a great self-contained run of kind of like pulp horror, occult strangeness, weird fiction, all this stuff. Yeah,
it gave me a similar feeling to Hellier, but perhaps on a lower level of like wanting me to. I really wanted to look into that stuff then.
Yeah,
you know, I read it. There was a reading list, wasn't there, Buckley, that we used to talk about a lot. Yeah,
I watched it three times in a row. I just watched it again and just watched it again. Like, it was just like
that episode with the fight and the single take.
Oh, it's astonishing. Yeah, just as a bit of filmmaking, it's great.
Do you think that there's any other TV shows that are comparable in terms of influence on that sort of community or that sort of way of thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the big one is surely Twin Peaks, I think. Like, it's such a fascinating show and clearly a show that has been made by people who understand this stuff. I mean, obviously, David Lynch, co-created by David Lynch and Mark Frost. Lynch is famous for being into transcendental meditation. He's very interested in the world of the imagination, the world of dreams, which obviously I know you guys are from previous episodes of this show. And all his work is about dream logic and the subconscious and has these wonderful undercurrents going through it. At the same time, Mark Frost is kind of often a little bit forgotten about, I think, but his influence is incredibly important. Because although I don't believe he's a practitioner, he is absolutely very knowledgeable about this stuff.
Yeah,
he's fascinated in all realms of the paranormal. He's done a lot of reading on magic. He's a ufologist. So actually, I interviewed him a few years back and got to talk to him about a UFO sighting that he had when he was younger. And he brings that kind of, I don't know if reality is the right word when you're talking about this stuff, but like he brings an understanding of the history of these things. So if you read his book, The Secret History of Twin Peaks, that's full of things like, you know, Jack Parsons and all the kind of mythology of rural America.
There's a beautiful melding there of the intuitive and the analytical, you know, with Lynch being the intuitive and Frost being the analytical. And that's something I think, again, that me and Buckley have discussed and that we're hoping to discuss in future episodes a bit, is that because that's the perfect yin and yang there.
Yeah, completely, absolutely. And I just think there's no way that you can watch something like Twin Peaks: The Return and not kind of see it as a beautiful example of occult art. I mean, you even have things like this, like the central thesis of the show. You know, Twin Peaks, two polarities. You know, the Black Lodge and the White Lodge, with our reality somewhere in the middle between these kind of like not exactly heaven, not exactly hell, but like these two other worlds, these two dimensions that kind of with us. Somewhere in the middle, you know.
Yeah, I think it definitely primed my brain back, you know, 20 years ago when me and Buckley first were watching that, and I think it definitely sort of set us on this sort of course that has eventually led here, magnified by the lens of Hellier. But I mean, that's an interesting point because, you know, talking about how these things correct the course of your life or alter the course of your life in some way, that there's some people who, or a lot of people really, who consider Hellier to be some sort of initiation, not even just for the people who are within the show, you know, Greg Dana and Connor and Carl and Tyler, but the people who are watching the show as well, you know. And I think that the key to all of Hellier is in season 2, episode 7, when they interview Alan Greenfield. And he hints very, very heavily at them being part of a magical ritual. So do you think that this is right, that Hellier is some sort of initiation, either for the cast and crew of Hellier or for the people watching it, or for both?
So I think it comes back to that quote that you read out from Greg Newkirk. I think it's about re-enchanting the world, about re-enchanting the viewers. And in that way, then, yeah, because like you say, you watch this show and you started a paranormal podcast. There are loads of people who've watched this show and become interested enough to start investigating or start practicing various strands of occultism. Like, whether or not it is actually itself a magical ritual, does that matter? Because it's had clearly magical effects. You know, it's actually created tangible change, you know?
Yeah, results-based magic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. I tend to always feel a little cynical about this stuff and kind of go, it's a brilliant hook, that, and a brilliant sort of end point or stopping point for the series in its current form to kind of go, we went on this investigation and now we've created an initiation ritual, which has changed our lives and also changed yours. But again, yeah, it has in some ways for some people. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think at the very end of season 2, they basically come out of it thinking nothing's really happened. Like, they've just got a bit of a feeling rather than an actual event happening. But you think sort of maybe what happened was not about what happened to them, but what happened outside of that. You know, if it is like a bigger picture type thing, it's not necessarily important whether or not something extreme happened to Greg, Dana, Carl, Connor and Tyler. It's about what's happening in the world outside, and perhaps it is causing a domino effect and there's lots of little vases popping up everywhere and, you know, other podcasts, yeah, and other investigations and stuff. Because I think, like, we've talked about these other shows which have influence, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there's that many people who've watched Twin Peaks who've gone on to necessarily want to try doing things. And the same with the X-Files, and the same with, like whereas Hellier kind of almost encourages you, and Pennyroyal to an extent as well, you know, it actually encourages you to become like that, and to, because you basically want to be Greg. You know, I sound like I'm joking, but that was the feeling I got when I'm watching it. I was like, and I remember talking to Mark about it, our previous guest Field Lines cartographer, and we were just saying, like, yeah, don't you just wish you could, you know, quit your job and just do what Greg does all day, because it'd be, yeah, great. And it does make you feel that way, and it does make you feel like, more than anything else, makes me feel like, I feel like this is something that I'd like to actively investigate rather than just read about as fiction.
Yeah, and in that Somewhere in the Skies podcast I was listening to earlier, Greg said Hellier is a toolbox, and he said it quite seriously. You know, I mean, basically, I think he really does want to, and I think they all do really want to go out there and encourage people. I think that it's, I think it's in the final episode of season 2. Carl says it might be bigger than us, bigger than just the cave that night. It might be this project itself. The results of the ritual might not even happen to us. I keep thinking about this idea that they might happen to the audience at home watching this as part of the ritual.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
But whether it's an actual initiation or not, I'm not sure. You know, whether, I don't think that you can just watch Hellier and have your life changed. I think that it's more of an inspiration than an initiation. It's an inspiration to become initiated. You are given the prod and the prompt by watching Hellier. If you are excited by that, if you're influenced by that, then you can get up and do something. Because for me, Hellier is about reaching up and touching something, you know. And I mean, that's obviously what's happening to them. But if you draw influence from that, then it makes you feel that you too can go out and do that.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you just mentioned the X-Files Berkeley and briefly, and I think in some ways the X-Files did have that huge effect because it was such a big show. It was so massive, and you listen to interviews with paranormal investigators and ufologists and people like that, and almost all of them will, you know, if they're of our age or kind of roughly our age, almost all of them will go, well, it started because I watched the X-Files and I want it to be Mulder, or I want it to be Scully. But the difference there is obviously that is overtly fiction, and Hellier comes with a reading list, right? Hellier actually presents you with things like Secret Cipher of Ufonauts or Mothman Prophecies or John Keel, all these people and ideas that you can then research, because as you say, it's an internet phenomena. It's all this stuff is a few finger clicks away. So it does open doors more quickly and far more doors as well, you know?
Yeah, it's like a web itself, isn't it? You know, and you, there's all these different parts to it. And that's something that's shown in Technicolor, in Pennyroyal, you know, that the lengths that you can take that to, that just the amount, I mean, you could probably spend a lifetime researching and reading what's in Pennyroyal. There's so much there. It's so information dense. There's so many different rabbit holes that you could disappear down. You know, it really could be a lifetime's work, which I'm sure it is for Nathan Paul Isaac and his crew.
Yeah, I mean, it makes you wonder, like, how much are they aware of it? Like, in that respect, you get the impression sort of towards the end of season two that they're a bit more aware, you know, of almost it from a meta point of view, as in we're a TV show and we're like, there's a bit when they go into that final cave to play the notes, the tones to Pan, where Dana says the entrance to the cave didn't look real. It looked like a movie set. And that really struck me as like almost a little, even though she's not a fictional character, but if that was a film or a book, then that would be almost like a little clue as to what was going on. You know, it's like, it's kind of almost acknowledging that it's TV. It's like TV that knows it. And then also in that same episode, like she, if you remember, she gets Greg to do the invocation, whereas originally it was her that was supposed to do it because she's the witch. She's the one that has all the knowledge of that stuff. But she gets Greg to do it and she says, I don't know why, I just felt he needed to be the one to do it. And of course he needs to be the one to do it because he's the leader. He's the archetype.
He's the chosen one.
Yeah, he's the archetype of the chosen one, the leader. So Dana knows intuitively that that is what has to be done in order to make something happen. And I thought that in particular kind of really lent that kind of meta edge to it. Like, is our life a show? Like, the lines blurring between like that. And again, it's that whole sort of Chapel Perilous situation of like making you feel like, am I being watched? Am I being controlled? It's pretty mind blowing, really.
It's like it's hyper real, isn't it? You know, there's that weird quality to it all.
Yeah.
Where we're being told it's real life, but we're not experiencing it that way at all. I'm not sure that they are either. That there's something else to it, you know, and I think it might even come back to this second order cybernetics idea. You know, it's almost like Hellier is sort of watching itself, you know, as it spirals in and follows its the synchronicities and so on, that they're also sort of the media itself is almost folding in on itself.
Yeah.
You know, because they're season two, I think, is it episode six of season two where season one of Hellier premieres.
Yeah.
And so then they start getting feedback from the audience, you know, and that tightens in.
That's when they start getting the stuff from the wizards, isn't it? Like from the magicians, sorry, not wizards. When magicians start to tell them, yeah, you're going through an initiation.
That's very, very curious. And I think something that's examined again very, very well in Pennyroyal. So having sort of examined it from a sort of cultural perspective, Will, what do you think is really going on in Helio? If you had a theory, what do you think it is?
I thought about this, and my disappointing answer is I have no idea. I think it's, you know, there's just so much to it. I think you could take the slightly cynical route and go, well, it's some talented filmmakers with no budget found a way to make a compelling narrative out of basically no resources, and turn that to an advantage purely because they've got a good inherent knowledge of esoteric stuff. You know, they run a paranormal museum. Dana's a witch. They know this stuff, and they found a compelling way to weave in their own lives into it. And I think that's absolutely possible. Maybe that's even the most likely option. But when you watch it, there's so much stuff, that so many details, so many weird tangents and coincidences and synchronicities and just odd little things, that it would be an absolute nightmare to plot. You know, I have no idea how you would go about plotting something this dense and complex. And that kind of gives it, adds to its sense of truthfulness. So maybe it's real. I don't know.
Yeah. I think if they were going to make it, if they were going to make something up, they would have had something a bit more exciting than a tin can, you know. Yeah. And I think that I don't know, it seems to be like a bit of a stretch to think that they, you know, that they would have had like some little critter running about or something, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I was listening to some podcasts, and I think one was Beyond Bigfoot. I'll link to it in the show notes. But basically, they shopped it around some TV networks, Hell Yeah Season 1, when they'd filmed it. And none of them would pick it up because it wasn't in a standard paranormal show format. And one, apparently, so Greg says, one network was like, okay, what we'll do is we'll cut it down to episodes, and each episode's in a different state. And in every state, you find a goblin.
Ah.
And Greg was like, what do you mean find a goblin? And it was a bit like nudge nudge wink wink, you know what I mean, we'll find a goblin sort of thing. And it is admirable that they stayed their course and kept it on. And that's another reason that I think that there's something very real going on there, because it is fairly uncompromising in what it is. Like Buckley was saying, the climax of season one is finding a used tin can on the ground. You know, you couldn't, no television writer would have the balls, the sheer long balls to say, you know, and at the very end they find a tin can on the ground.
Yeah.
But if you've been following the show, that's weighted with significance, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And look, so I guess, you know, another possibility is that someone is genuinely messing with them for genuinely magical purposes or for just some strange idea of their own, maybe some weird Discordian prank. But again, yeah, that seems deeply unlikely as well, because, you know, the letters that come from David Christie that set them off on this path lead them to a guy called Terry Rist, who may or may not be real. I mean, that's a strange name and they assume it's a pseudonym. But then later in the show, you kind of get the sense, oh, possibly he is real. And that leads them to a book, Secret Cipher of the Euphonauts. And maybe it was by the author of that. Who knows? Like, who would do this? How would you do this? It just kind of really stretches plausibility that someone would be able to plan this incredibly dense, long-running prank, basically.
The idea of there being some sort of Svengali behind it is almost as implausible as there being goblins, isn't it?
Yes.
Because no one could have anticipated what would happen, because even if someone messed with them by sending the original David Christie emails, there's no way that that same person planted a tin can in a tunnel in Kentucky, is there?
Yeah.
So how do you get from one space to the next? I think in my mind, I don't know what you guys think about this, but I don't think there were any goblins. That bit to me doesn't seem real. That initial email, I think, is some sort of prank, wind-up, or lead-on. I don't think that those photos are photos of goblins. I don't think that those footprints are goblin or Bigfoot footprints. I don't think that's too cynical to look at. I mean, they say, well, look, these have dermal ridges on and so on, but you can fake dermal ridges, you know, that's the least of what's going on here. But I think that it's almost like a, you know, like activation energy for a catalyst, you know, this is what brings them together and puts them into this state where they are basically entering into the synchronicity storm. Was that done intentionally for that purpose, or was that an accident? You know, someone messed with them, it brought them together, and one by one, the synchronicities started coming. It's like we talked about in the, I think it was episode 5, about whether the Book of the Law was actually delivered by this ultra-terrestrial being to Crowley. It doesn't really matter, because what's happened since is truly magical.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think it's that whole thing, isn't it, where it's like you... And again, it's a magical principle, but it carries across into lots of other areas of life, is that sometimes you've got to truly believe in something for it to work. And, you know, like with you've kind of got to almost immerse yourself into it and believe that it's going to work. And I think with Hellier, you almost had, you know, a team of people who did truly believe in it. And so something did happen, and it wasn't necessarily... It didn't mean that it had to be done by, like you say, some kind of trickster with that intention. But either way, what happened was the feedback loop occurred, and the whatever it is, this thing, this phenomenon, however you want to describe it, it kind of created this sort of vortex of it all coming together and happening in this place to these people because of the unique group of people that they were, and because of who was watching them and how they presented it and all of that. And it just kind of, it was like a perfect storm, is how I could have said that far more succinctly.
Yeah. And it's interesting because on that very last episode, Tyler Strand is talking about how, because after they go to the cave, obviously Connor dives deep into the numbers and they run through those original numbers from the original messages, and they get this passage from Lieber 31. And Tyler Strand says, oh, so that was actually pointing towards this passage from a book. But I went there to the coordinates and I found the balloon and I found the green man, you know, so that happened as well, you know. So it's as if, you know, like Buckley was just saying, that the act of believing is making things happen. And I think that is magic, isn't it?
Yeah.
I wonder if the same thing is happening Pennyroyal, because again, what starts off as a fairly local investigation into a few murders in Kentucky becomes basically like a global conspiracy. And was that global conspiracy there, or has it been somehow created and fueled by those guys investigating into it? I don't know if there is an answer. I don't know if there's a beginning or an end to that, you know, or if it's just a circle.
And it might keep happening.
Well, yeah, that's it, you know. And I wonder how deep you can go. And I wonder, you know, like maybe that idea of Chapel Perilous is like some sort of stopping point that you have to stop at, you know, because you can just go deeper and deeper and deeper. I think for that comes back to what Nathan Paul Isaac was saying about, you know, if you look too deeply into these hidden files, you'll cause the whole system to crash. You know, we shouldn't be going that deep into the fabric of what's making up.
There's a quote by Robert Anton Wilson about Chapel Perilous, which kind of addresses that. So he says, it's a well-known quote, so people might already know this one, but and I'm going to paraphrase it just to take out a couple of bits that are less relevant. In researching occult conspiracies, one eventually faces a crossroads of mythic proportions called Chapel Perilous in the trade. You come out on the other side either stone paranoid or an agnostic. There is no third way. Once you're inside it, there doesn't seem to be any way to ever get out again until you suddenly discover that it has been brought into existence by thought and does not exist outside thought. Everything you fear is waiting with slavering jaws in Chapel Perilous, but if you are armed with the wand of intuition, the cup of sympathy, the sword of reason, and the pentacle of valour, you will find there, the legends say, the medicine of metals, the elixir of life, the philosopher's stone, true wisdom, and perfect happiness.
Nice.
So that's, and I like how that ties in the kind of magical imagery as well with the pentacle and the chalice and stuff.
Yeah. I wonder if the Hellier guys are heading towards Chapel Perilous. I mean, like Greenfield has said that they seem to have avoided it, and it might be in the way that they're approaching it.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of them things, isn't it? Because when you look at Greg actually does specifically admit what he's done magic-wise, he's basically dabbling in bits and pieces here and there. Robert Anton Wilson was basically dabbling in bits and pieces. You know, he was doing like Crowley, Thelemite-type magic rituals, but he was also doing other stuff and like... Is that what causes it? I don't know.
I don't know what you think, Will, about the end of the series of Hellier, like in season two, because like Buckley was saying about Greg dabbling in magic, it seems like at season two, at the end, they seem to be throwing anything at the wall to see what will stick, you know, that they hypnotize Carl, they go to a cave and try to summon Pan. I don't particularly think, I don't know what your take is on whether this is a construct for television or not, but I don't think that the Pan thing is particularly relevant to the larger case of Hellier. What do you reckon?
I think you're absolutely right in that they do kind of just throw things at the wall to a certain degree. You have the alien abduction strand, which is really interesting, but also feels quite disconnected from all the Rite of Pan stuff. I think if I was to be a little bit cynical again, because I rewatched the last episode yesterday, and a bit that stuck out to me kind of slightly clangingly is where Dana is defining the word Nox and its occult meaning, and says it means Knight of Pan, and Greg goes, what? It's like, you're a couple, you've probably had this chat off camera. But obviously, you know, again, they've got to make it entertaining. So I do understand.
I had a thought about that actually today in terms of like my initial thought upon watching the last episode when the first time I watched it was the whole tones thing. Although that was one of my favorite parts of it initially when it came up in the spirit box session. The way that they went about it in the cave was bullshit because they, I mean, they basically, unless Dana has perfect pitch and can remember the exact pitches, there are thousands of increments of pitch that it could be. There's not just the notes, it was the notes C-A-F, but there's other notes in between that that aren't on the Western scale. It just so happened that this ancient god chose, I don't know, I don't buy that, and I don't buy the fact that Connor was just able to play them and Dana was like, yes, that's the one. I just don't think that happened. And also the fact that they played them out through laptop speakers in this cave, like just this tiny little tinny speaker, like it's not even going to cause any vibration or anything. Like, so initially I was very cynical about that, but upon rewatching the final episode, which I rewatched today for the third time in preparation for this, it occurred to me, and I started just looking at it totally differently. It doesn't matter that ritual, they didn't use the tones in a way that I thought was scientifically proper. It doesn't matter because the point is not that I'm convinced by it. It's the point that they were convinced by it and that most people were convinced by it. And so for all intents and purposes, that happened. So it wasn't for me. It wasn't for people who are analyzing the physics of sound or with that kind of knowledge. It doesn't matter, and you can't think about it like that. If you think about it like that, your sigils aren't going to work. You know,
It's you're absolutely right. It's creating that reality in their minds in that situation. And it's also just incredibly evocative. That scene is, it's the most memorable part of the season, I would say. Those moments. Absolutely.
Do you guys think that they actually summoned Pan?
No.
I don't think so. I think they'd know about it.
Jesus Christ. I mean, I've seen pictures of the dude and he's not to be trifled with. I mean,
for one thing, you know, you'd expect there to be some sort of panic, which is really not what happens in the cave, you know, because for me, I think the reason it works so well is the end of the second season, even if it is slightly tacked on and even if it wasn't an actual, I mean, the ritual itself looks very convincing, doesn't it? And I think Greg does an incredible job of doing his part in that. But what it does more than anything else is that feeling of catharsis, you know, yeah. all that. And you can see that in Greg, you know, when he's the emotion that he's putting into it. And I think that at that point is the point where it stops being about the reality of what's happening. And that's when it crosses more into like a satisfying television moment. You know, yeah. that catharsis, you know, Greg shouting, you know, EO Pan and you know, the whole, the way the cave looks like Buckley was saying, you know, yeah. it does look like a movie. The candles everywhere, you know, the characters all standing round. It's a fairly good climax, really, for the whole series.
Yeah, completely.
Has Hellier and Pennyroyal had a permanent effect on you, Will? And how would you recommend someone, you know, goes in and processes those, you know, those two things?
So I wonder how much of this is down to the pandemic and lockdown to a certain degree. So when that happened, and I moved into my house the day before the first lockdown, I live on my own, and it was like, hey, you've got a new house, you bought your first house, what an amazing moment in your life. Oh, by the way, fucker, it's jail, you're stuck here now forever. And like part of the way that I coped with that was in getting into stuff that I found comforting, or listening to things that I found comforting. And that's been podcasts. I listen to comedy podcasts, I listen to some film stuff. I really liked that show, Unexplained.
The podcast.
Yeah,
I like that one.
In its first few seasons especially, and I wanted more stuff like that. I've always been interested in UFOs, so I started listening to Somewhere in the Skies, which you've mentioned, which is very good. And then just started getting pulled more in the more esoteric direction, some of which I think are great, some of which I think are not so hot. And then seeing Hellier at that time as well. And I think there's not a small chance that basically just being stuck in my house, absorbing this stuff for days on end made me a little bit nuts for a while. So yes, it had an effect on me in that sense, but it's definitely left an impact on my imagination. It's definitely changed the way that I look at some stuff. So personally, I was practicing various occult things for a while a few years ago, and then I stopped because I started to notice some weird stuff happening, like nothing aggressively weird, but just some very strange things, like encounters with some very odd people and situations. So I knocked it on the head, and then recently, kind of off of the back of this, I've gotten more interested in it again. I've started learning tarot a little bit and dabbling in those areas, and again, like I come at it from a kind of, I want to say rationalist, but this is very irrational stuff, right? But I try to come at it always from a point of view of, well, it could just be in your head, right? Maybe none of this stuff actually means anything. Maybe none of it's real. But as we've said a bunch of times tonight, if it makes an impact on you, if it changes your mind or makes the world more beautiful and strange, then it has happened, right? So I had a tarot experience a couple of weeks back that, which I probably mentioned to you guys over Twitter, felt like being punched in the face with meaning. I was in this class, did a little free card spread. We were basically doing spreads for ourselves, asking questions. And it gave me such a coherent answer about where I am in my emotional life that I burst into tears in front of this room full of people. And then had an immediate amazing coincidence, which is I stepped out to get a breath of fresh air. And this was in Bristol, in this lovely rural, or this lovely building with a lovely garden out the back. And there was a fox sat watching me. And I was like, wow, it's a fox. Cool. Beautiful. Dried my eyes, went back inside, sat down. Next part of the class starts. And this guy walks in who hadn't been in the first part of the class. And the tutor goes, oh, hey, what's your name? And he goes, I'm Fox. And it's like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And again, like, maybe none of that stuff means anything, but so much of it has happened. Like, so stuff like after I'd been doing sigils for a while, going home to visit my mum in Yorkshire and seeing a guy on the train reading a book, and he had a very distinctive tattoo, which was of a typewriter. And I was like, oh, I bet he's a writer. That's kind of a slightly Garth Marenghi-esque thing to do, have a tattoo of a typewriter. And didn't speak to him. This was in East Yorkshire. I was like, cool, like, wonder what he does. Literally 2 weeks later, I'm talking to him in the bar because I've just walked into a bar and he stood there. And I'm like, were you in Bridlington 2 weeks ago? And he's like, yeah. And this was in London, sorry, I should say where I met him. And it's like, what?
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, thanks very much for sharing those.
Yeah, that is exactly the kind of thing that we're kind of that we're sort of looking for, isn't it?
So, I mean, it sounds like, at least for us three here, that Greg Newkirk's got what he wanted in terms of re-enchanting our worlds, at least. And Will, you've definitely been part of, however indirectly or directly, enchanting my world. I think you have the official title of being the godfather of Vase, really.
Yeah.
I bestow that upon you, Will Salmon. Arise.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, we wanted you to come on the show, you know, and we discussed it and stuff, but like, it was about finding kind of the right topic almost. And yeah. I think that we wanted to do a Hellier show, and then
we were stuck on it, weren't we?
We were stuck on how to approach it. And then I was like, well, why don't we get Salmon in for that one? Because he is the one that showed it to us. And Hellier was what sparked it off, but Salmon was the one who showed that to us. And he's got the background in TV writing, so it makes perfect sense that he, be in on that one. And it's I've really enjoyed it. I think it's been a really good episode.
Yeah, absolutely. So with it in mind that we're sort of coming to the end and we're going to wrap up. And I think given your job and what you do for a living, have you got any recommendations that you can give our listeners of things that, if they like Hellier and they like Pennyroyal, you will also like this?
So Audie mentioned Something in the Dirt. That's coming out in a few weeks from now. We're at the start of August. It's coming out later this month, I believe, on streaming and certainly in some cinemas. That's really worthwhile. I think anyone who's interested in occultism, in ufology to a degree, and esoteric stuff will get a real kick out of that, especially if you liked those directors' previous films, The Endless. I forget the name of the first one.
Resolution.
Thank you, yes. Another thing that we talked on briefly earlier, but I think is kind of relevant, is The Leftovers. And, you know, I'll jump at any chance to talk about The Leftovers because I think it's almost perfect. It's certainly one of the TV shows that has made the most impact on me. But I do think there's a relevance there, because a rough premise is it's set in a world where there has been a rapture-like event where 2% of the population has inexplicably vanished. And the show is not about that in the slightest. It's about loss and how you deal with unimaginable tragedy. Like, it's basically, certainly in its first season anyway, it's about 9/11 to a certain degree, I would say. But then as it progresses, it's based on a novel by Tom Perrotta, and the first series is a very close adaptation of the book. But then as it goes into seasons 2 and 3, it becomes much stranger and more metaphysical, and it becomes about ideas of faith and about the fine line between divinity and madness. And the show is very, very ambiguous, and it plays a game throughout of, is this real or is this just your head? But it strings on, it piles on coincidences and synchronicities and characters encountering evidence of what seems to be some sort of divine force, or just the universe messing with them, or reality just getting a little bit slippery. And again, I suppose, like Hellier, it's a show, although it does have a conclusive ending, a really beautiful ending as well. It never truly, anyway, explains where the show stands on that, and if they how much of the show is true is truly magical. I think the showrunner Damon Lindelof has said, if 2% of the population have vanished, then 2% of the show is supernatural, and the rest of it is, for want of better words, real. I think it's a great show. I think it's really, really beautiful. I know you're a big fan, Buckley, and
Hannah's too. Who's in it?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Oh, sorry.
Nods from us. Yeah.
It's another show that I passed on to him from you.
And so, Will, how can our listeners find you? I mean, your social contacts, rather than actually turning up at your house.
So you can read my stuff in SFX magazine every month, which is still my favourite magazine. I'm very proud to be associated with that. You can find me on Twitter, where I talk a lot of shit. I'm at Evil Robot Bill, yes, as in the Bill and Ted film, which is great. I love Bill and Ted. You can find me on Instagram under the same handle. I run a small tape label, which both Field Lines and Polypores have been tangentially involved in. It's called Modern Aviation, and we put out music that's kind of on the axis of electronic stuff, folk stuff, where they interact, music that's kind of, that hopefully makes you feel strange and nice.
Nice. Thanks very much. And if you want to contact us at Vace, you can get us at vaceinfo@gmail.com. We have a website now that's up and running, www.vace.co.uk. And you can also follow us, as always, on Twitter and Instagram. And that is VaySeesYav. So that's Vace, and Vace spelt backwards. Also, I'd like to mention now that a super talented co-host has now released all of the music that you can hear in this podcast. And is there some in there as well that isn't, that we haven't used yet?
That we haven't used. So there's an entire, it's just like a volume one basically, but it's everything that you've heard, all of the music that you've heard on the show so far is now available to download.
And where is that?
Yeah, so you can find the soundtrack at vace.bandcamp.com. It will be linked in the show notes, and it's also on the website. So if you want to support the show and to fund us buying more books and going on trips places, then as it stands, the best way to do it is to actually buy this soundtrack album, because it costs just £5, and it's a donation that will go to us, which means that we'll be able to sort of do more stuff with the show, buy more books, keep the research going, travel to different places, etc. So if you like the music, or if you like the show, buy the soundtrack album, download it and listen to it. And or even if you just don't listen to it and you just want to give us a fiver, you know, that too would be much appreciated.
Yeah, and I've put a link onto that on the website as well. So even if you just want to go through the website, you can find our Twitter handle, our Instagram, Bandcamp, all from that one place, www.vase.co.uk. This is actually the first show that we've done since we've launched the podcast. And I just want to thank everyone who's listened. Feedback's been so good, so helpful, so useful.
Yeah.
if you enjoy the show, please, particularly on Apple Podcasts, if you can just give us a quick review, give us you can use the stars, your star click thing. You can just leave a few words for us, it really does help us. You know, it helps get the show sort of listened to more, and it gives us feedback, which we're always happy to receive. And we've had some really useful feedback, particularly we were emailed by Ben, who gave us some really interesting points of research that we're going to look into. And there's Keith B on Twitter, Bob Plant, as always, Phil Lang's cartographer, Giants of Discovery. I can't sort of list every single person, but we're really, really appreciative of people who are listening and enjoying it.
Yeah, it's been really nice to have people interact with us on Twitter and just like send us messages recommending books, or you know, send us just commenting and talking about their own experiences and things like that. It's it feels really nice to be kind of building like a little community, but also sort of it feels like it could be, as we've discussed in this before, yet another stage, another level of initiation. You know, are we initiating people in the same way that Greg Newkirk initiated us?
We can only hope. And Will, thanks so much for your time. You've been so generous with your time here and the things that you've said and all the interesting stuff that you've talked about. We really, really appreciate it.
It's been great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I think thank you both. It was a real joy to be a part of. So thank you.
Before you go, Will, you may have noticed that at the end of each episode we try and clear the air a little, like you would at the end of a magical working. So yeah, in order to clear the air, lighten the mood a little, I have a question for you.
Okay.
If you were stuck on an island perhaps similar to the island on Lost. Yeah. A mysterious and weird island that you've no way of getting off. Which member of the Helia team, and this includes periphery players in Helia, so it's not just the five, it includes people like Dr. Alan Greenfield. Who would you rather have on the island? And bear in mind, they're on your side. So it's your companion and someone who's on the island with you and on your side.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because my first thought was Alan Greenfield, and in my head I was thinking, because he's kind of like, to a degree, maybe he's like Locke, but I don't think he is. I think he's more like
Ben Linus.
He's Ben Linus. I don't mean that to say that I know there's one theory that Greenfield is the man behind what's going on Helia, and I don't believe that's true. But he's definitely he knows things, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Ben Linus is like one of my top three Lost characters. So,
well, that's the thing, isn't it? Is he the secret hero of Lost?
I don't know. I mean, I think from a purely survival point of view, you'd kind of think Tyler Strand, because he's like...
It's got to be Tyler Strand, isn't
so
it?
He's so gung-ho. I mean,
He's never tired. He's never scared. You know, like, I would just like jump onto his back and let him carry, like Yoda at the end in The Empire Strikes Back. And he could just sort of carry me across the island in complete safety, you know, whilst I just sort of chatted to him and picked his brain about sort of cave monsters and stuff. Yeah, so he's definitely be my choice. What about you, Buckley?
Tyler. I think it'd have to be Tyler. I think he's the hero. Although, having said that, I you know, if I'm gonna die on this island, it would be kind of cool having Greenfield, like, because he's got all the stories, so you'd never be bored. You know.
Yeah, no, that's true. I thought you were going to say that if you were to die on that island, that the last person you'd like to see would be Greg Newkirk. Yeah.